From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
In Puerto Rico, still no sense of relief. I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. President Trump says Puerto Rico was a disaster before Hurricane Marina hit the island almost a month ago. Now the slow pace of federal relief has created outrage.
We shed blood to defend the freedoms that every American in this country enjoys. So to kick fellow citizens when they are down is shameful.
Many younger people have already moved away, leaving the sick and elderly behind, often without electricity and with scarce water, sometimes fouled by toxic chemicals. We'll hear from San Juan, and we'll talk to a woman who's heading home to assist her family in Puerto Rico instead of planning for her upcoming wedding. On today's Talking Point later, lessons from a totalitarian mafia state. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app. Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. Most people in Puerto Rico are still without electricity, and some are drinking from a well contaminated by a Superfund site. President Trump's accused of a shocking lack of compassion compared to speedy assistance after hurricanes hit Texas and Florida. We'll talk more about the island of Puerto Rico with 3.4 million American citizens. Today's talking point, modern Russia looks a lot like the Soviet Union, and that's why Vladimir Putin's been able to cement his power. I'll talk with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen about a traumatized population. First, this news update. Two American allies are pitted against each other as the Iraqi military is moving into Kirkuk 3 weeks after the Kurdistan region voted overwhelmingly to declare independence. Borju Daragahi is correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He's based in Istanbul. Borju Daragahi, welcome back as always.
It's a pleasure.
Give us the background. Kirkuk is the capital of the Kurdistan region, and it drove out the Islamic State militants recently. So what's the reason for military action?
Well, Kirkuk is not the capital of the Kurdistan region.
I thought it was. Excuse me.
Kirkuk is a city that is very much claimed by Kurds. It has a majority Kurdish population, but it's actually not officially part of the Kurdistan regional government. And the Kurds have claimed that this has been a flashpoint, a potential powder keg for years now, this issue of Kirkuk. And it was supposed to be decided constitutionally through a political process. As most things in Iraq are kind of dysfunctional. It hasn't been decided. It hasn't been resolved. There's oil there. The Kurds want it. The Arabs want at least the oil fields, maybe not the city itself. The Kurds do not have an independent state or possibility of creating an independent state without those oil revenues. So they really want that. And after this referendum that basically all of the Kurds' allies beseeched them not to hold, tensions ratcheted up very quickly. Other regional powers got involved and I think emboldened to some extent by the winding down of the ISIS conflict. They moved overnight and seized the city as well as the oil fields and other facilities, including the Kirkuk airport.
If Kirkuk is not, in fact, the capital of their region, and thank you for correcting me on that, what's the rationale for moving in there?
What's the rationale for the
Kurds?
It's a majority Kurdish population, and the Kurds definitely covet that area. They say that it's part of their homeland. But it's not officially part of the three-province Kurdish region. This goes back to the history of Iraq and the betrayal of the Kurds after World War I and the what was considered a policy of Arabization on the part of various governments, including that of Saddam Hussein, whereby areas of the country that were traditionally Kurdish were repopulated with Arabs from other parts of Iraq. And so, you know, this has been a huge source of resentment on the part of the Iraqi Kurds, and they've wanted it. They have the majority of the people there. They consider it part of their territory, so to speak. And this referendum was meant to kind of consolidate their hold on that. But what it did, in fact, was provoke the government of Baghdad, which was backed by Iran as well as Turkey and other governments, to move and to act, and they did.
Thank you for a lot of history in a very short time. How much of a problem is this for the Trump administration? We supported the Kurds, particularly when they drove the Islamic State out of Kirkuk. But, of course, we also support the Iraqi government.
Yeah, I think it is a bit of a quandary for the U.S., but there are quite a few indications that so long as the government of Baghdad does not move to move its offensive towards those three provinces of the Iraqi Kurdistan region, people aren't going to do a lot. I mean, Masoud Barzani, who's the leader of the Iraqi Kurds, he was warned not to hold this referendum. He was warned by his good friends, his neighbors, his rivals, you know, his partners, do not hold this referendum. There was even people in Iraqi Kurdistan, including in the second city of Soleimaniyah, who were like, this is a bad idea. We shouldn't do this. And so in a way, he kind of pushed himself out on a limb and put himself in a sort of tough situation. And now, you know, you have a Baghdad government that has, you know, emboldened by perhaps even some tacit diplomatic nods. Let's note that Haider Abadi, the prime minister of Iraq, was just a few days before this crisis erupted in Paris, meeting with Macron. France is a traditional ally of Iraqi Kurds. So I think that, you know, I doubt that this issue would not have come up in those meetings. So there's even a possibility that Western powers, at least to some extent, knew that this was going to happen.
Okay, so there is international support then for what the Iraqis are doing. In the meantime, the Kurds are fleeing. Where are they going?
They're going to that three-province Iraqi Kurdistan region. Those three provinces are Erbil, Soleimaniyah, and Duhok. They are, you know, solidly under the control of Iraqi Kurds. You need a separate visa, so to speak, to go there. It's already a de facto state. It's not semi-autonomous. It's an autonomous area. And so they're going there as Kurds have fled for, you know, hundreds of years as the Arabs have come. And this is the real tragedy, you know. This is the real tragedy of all of this, is that after 2003, when the U.S. toppled the government in Baghdad, there was sort of a gentleman's agreement between the parties in Iraq to resolve these sorts of deals and disputes politically.
All right. Obviously, these disputes continue, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. Borju Deragahi with BuzzFeed News. Many thanks to you. In a moment, Puerto Rico, still no sense of relief. On To The Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alney back with To The Point. It's been almost a month since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. At least 48 people have died. 85% of the residents are still without power. In one small town west of the capital, San Juan, people are drinking from a well that's marked danger because it's potentially contaminated by a Superfund site. Late last week, New York Democrat Nidia Velasquez, the first person of Puerto Rican descent elected to Congress, addressed President Trump's tweets, saying the island was a disaster before it was hit by Maria.
Those tweets are unprecedented. The most basic fundamental responsibility of the President of the United States, the President of the most powerful country in the world, is to show up and make and provide the assistance and the relief that American citizens needs. They don't need this type of insult.
Nidia Velasquez, once again, a New York congresswoman. Christopher Flavel has been reporting on the response effort for Bloomberg. Good to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me.
Bring us up to date. Are they doing any better than when the congresswoman made those very strong comments?
Yeah, the numbers aren't good. As you mentioned, some 14% of customers have power. 59% have their telecommunication service back. Half of banks are open. Fewer than half of cell towers have been repaired. Things aren't good. If you look at press releases from FEMA, it's unclear if they're bragging or admitting defeat. I'm looking at one number that says of all the requests the government has received for temporary roofs on homes that lost theirs, they've only met about 10%. Now, I think FEMA would respond by saying this was a terrible disaster and we weren't ready for it, and this is the best you could hope for. It's hard to know. It's hard to adjudicate a claim like that because they're right. This is a really bad disaster, but it seems like by any reasonable measure, they haven't done a fantastic job dealing with it.
Could it have been predicted?
You know, I think that's probably impossible to answer. Maybe a better question is, should FEMA do a better job preparing for the unpredictable, preparing for not just one really bad storm, but a sequence of really bad storms, and then making sure that every season they're ready for that? I think the inescapable impression I get from FEMA is they are struggling to cope with these storms. And if climate change, if we know anything about climate change, is that the likelihood of this kind of succession of really bad storms only increases. So I think one question we've got to ask after this season is, what are they doing differently to better prepare for it?
Has the administration, the president's failure to admit the existence of climate change per se, gotten in the way?
You know, it's hard to know how much that is semantic. Certainly, a lot of the people I deal with in FEMA are professionals. They're very good at their job. They're career staff. They were there before this president. They'll be here after this president. But you've got to think at some level, just the difficulty in talking about the kinds of challenges that they're trying to deal with makes it harder to think about them, whether that means quantifying to the degree possible what rising sea levels will mean, what rising temperatures will mean. Climate change is sort of by its nature a little bit hard to quantify and predict, but if you can't even reasonably talk about the phenomenon and use those terms comfortably, I think it does in some unquantifiable way make it more challenging to address the problem.
You apparently by accident were copied on Pentagon emails discussing how to communicate the relief efforts to the public, how to deal with the public relations aspect of it. What did you find out from those emails that you simply got sent to you?
Yeah, all of a sudden, at the end of September, I started getting emails from DOD staff that I thought looked a bit unusual. And sure enough, after a few days, I realized that I wasn't supposed to be on that list. I tried to get off it, tried to tell them, and it...
You tried to get off?
You know what? I tried to say, to be fair, I'm not sure you're aware that I'm on this list. You might want to take me off. It didn't immediately work. And the impression I got from this barrage of internal communication materials from the government was a real sense of communication staff struggling with a tough situation and not really finding a good way to talk about it. And then that got worse as the president started tweeting about his dissatisfaction with the people of Puerto Rico and elected officials. And you could almost feel the anxiety rise of these communication staff trying to figure out what to say and how to spin the government's response as their own commander-in-chief was saying, it's the fault of the people of Puerto Rico.
So they were caught then between what they needed to do as the military and the assistance they needed to give and what the president was saying?
Yeah, I think, I think it'd be hard for anyone to put a good face on that. They were remarkably candid internally about the difficulty of making it look as though the government cared about what was happening in Puerto Rico, as the president himself was tweeting about how it was the fault of Puerto Rican officials for not doing a better job keeping services going on their island.
Christopher Flavel, once again with Bloomberg News, a climate change policy reporter. Armando Valdez Prieto is a lawyer, a writer, a political strategist. He's former director of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico's Offices of Management and Budget. He's joined us several times from San Juan, and he's back with us again today. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
Bring us up to date from on the ground. And to what extent have the military, has FEMA, been able to make up for some of the delays that we've heard about?
Well, frankly, we have not seen, as someone who's here in Puerto Rico, and I'm speaking for any number of people that I speak with, we have not really seen a significant improvement. I have not seen the intense military involvement that had been promised at one point to take over the relief efforts from FEMA staff. And we're seeing it on the street every day. The one thing that has really changed from the first few days after Hurricane Maria is that, at the very least, gasoline is easier to get. There aren't these very long lines at gas stations. But aside from that, there's still food that's not getting to stores, supplies that's not getting to people who need it, particularly in the rural areas. Communications are down. Electricity is one factor that continues to kind of swing back and forth. We were at 17% of the authorities' customers yesterday. Now we're down at 13.7%. And we've been as low as 7% even 2 or 3 weeks after the storm. So we're not seeing, I believe, a coherent and effective response, particularly from the federal government, to really start making progress on some of these very important issues.
Let me read one of the tweets from the President of the United States. Electric and all infrastructure was disaster before hurricanes. That was on October the 12th. He also said there's been a lack of accountability and that the governor in particular ought to be held to account. Of course, he's very specifically mentioned the mayor of San Juan, who very publicly said the sorts of things that you're saying some time ago. What about that? And was the infrastructure a disaster before the hurricane hit?
It all sounds like a bunch of excuses from the president, particularly coming from someone who 8 days after hurricane, or I should say Superstorm Sandy in New Jersey, was already complaining about how electricity was not back up in a number of communities in that state. And so now this is his Katrina, this is his Sandy, and I think that everybody is really looking for more than tweets and more than, you know, politicians making each other responsible for who should take care of what. I think what people really want to see is progress on the ground.
All right. He's also got Harvey to deal with, of course, in Texas and in Florida. Let me introduce Raul Reyes. He's an NBC contributor on a Latino basis, and he's also an opinion columnist for CNN. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, sir.
What do you say to the differences between what the president has done and what he has said with regard to Texas and Florida and what's going on in Puerto Rico?
Well, I have to say, you know, now I'm in New York City. I'm here on the mainland. It's at a macro level. It is. I think it is very disheartening, and not just for Puerto Ricans. I think for many Americans to see this, what appears to be, you know, a very disparate way of thinking in terms of Texas and Florida and now Puerto Rico. And one way we do know that's true is when you look at Morning Consult has been out with some polls showing how the public views Trump's response. And most of Americans say that, you know, the government response was about right in terms of Texas and Florida. But most Americans say their response was that the U.S. has not done enough for Puerto Rico. Only 32% of Americans approve of Trump's response to Puerto Rico. And I think when you go within the Latino community, not Puerto Ricans and all different, you know, sectors of our communities, there's this sort of cements in that image that the president already has that he is not, that, you know, he's somewhere between indifferent to hostile and to when it comes to Hispanic Americans, because in the beginning, people certainly felt that he was overlooking Puerto Rico. When he did go down to the island and we saw videos of him throwing the paper towels into the crowd, and then when he engaged in this, like, a Twitter feud with the mayor of San Juan, people felt that that was disrespectful. And so I think that, you know, there's in the Latino community, there's a lot of dissatisfaction. I would say if you want to, the only good thing I can see that has come out of it is I see here in New York, in Miami, in many different cities, the community response has really been wonderful because people are just realizing, well, we're going to have to help the island ourselves, our friends, our loved ones, our relatives. And people have organized many different types of benefits through their churches and charity groups. And we've also seen, you know, things on the national level, private things this weekend was a big telethon on Telemundo, Univision, and even NBC, you know, that brought out a lot of Latin music stars, and then, you know, people like Jennifer Lopez and A-Rod, all raising awareness and getting people to contribute to Puerto Rico, which is great. But, at a certain point, it would have been, in the ideal situation, we would have this type of leadership and commensurate compassion coming from our president. But this is the reality right now.
We'll hear from one of those Puerto Ricans who lives in this on the mainland, but who's going home a little later in our program. But let me ask you this. There are plenty of Hispanics and Latinos in Texas and Florida.
Right.
They got the relief very quickly. How much does this have to do not so much with ethnicity but with politics, given the fact that in Puerto Rico people are, 3.4 million of them, American citizens, but they can't vote?
Right. Well, the Puerto Ricans, the way they vote is a little complicated to people here on the mainland, because Puerto Ricans, they do actually vote in their local elections, of course.
Sure.
And then they vote in the U.S. primary, like they vote in the primaries. Like, for example, they went for Hillary Clinton. You know, they vote that way. But what they don't get to vote for in the presidential election, and although they have a congressional representative, it's a non-voting member. So that status, you know, that sort of a unique positioning that they have in the political sense means that they don't have a direct advocate in Congress. So it has been left to, say, different lawmakers in Florida, people like Luis Gutierrez from Illinois, to be their advocate and to speak out for them. And I do think some lawmakers are looking ahead, especially in Florida, and making sort of a calculation because Puerto Ricans are American citizens, they sort of have a plan B that some other people in the Caribbean who are hit hard by the hurricane may not have, which is they can move to the mainland. And one of the easiest places for them to move, where many have family and connections, is Florida. Now, the more Puerto Ricans that move into Florida, since Puerto Ricans tend to lean Democratic, that potentially makes that state, you know, more of a purple state, more of a swing state than it already is.
All right, let me go back to Armando Valdez Prieto in San Juan. Are you looking for more help from the politicians in this country who are of Puerto Rican descent?
Sure, of course. We have very strong connections with many of the kind of longtime Puerto Rican legislators or congressmen, Jose Serrano from New York, Luis Gutierrez, Nidia Velasquez, even Darren Soto, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago when I was on the panel. These are people who definitely speak for Puerto Rico, even though they don't technically represent us in Congress. And certainly the diaspora, those over 1 million Puerto Ricans that now live in Central Florida, which is a critical swing state, a million Puerto Ricans who live in the New York area, those are people who definitely, I believe, have a significant influence in politics on the mainland, and who certainly have the issues concerning Puerto Rico in their hearts and minds when they vote.
Are you hearing their voices?
Certainly. We're not just hearing their voices. I think we are seeing their solidarity with Puerto Rico in action. There has been, if one group of people from the U.S. has been consistently supportive of Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, it has been the over 5 million people who identify as being of Puerto Rican descent who live in the U.S.
Okay, now we're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation with Christopher Flavel, Armando Valdez Prieto, and Raul Reyes. We'll also talk with Angela Albela, who is a person who is, in fact, going home to Puerto Rico. We'll have her tell us why and what the circumstances are. On our talking point later, lessons from a totalitarian mafia state. I'll talk with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren, I'm back with To The Point. 13.7% of the people in Puerto Rico have access to electricity almost a month after Hurricane Maria struck that island. I want to go back to Christopher Flavelle, our climate change policy reporter from Bloomberg News. Tell us about the concrete differences between the way Puerto Rico has been handled by FEMA, by the military, as opposed to the way Texas and Florida have been handled since they were struck by hurricanes just a week or so before.
Yeah, one of the big differences we found is the timeline over which the governor of Puerto Rico asked for aid. In both Florida and a little bit in Texas, the governments there asked other states and the federal government for aid before the hurricane really hit or before it got bad, whereas in Puerto Rico, they got to wait until afterwards, the day after landfall. And then after that point, we found that the governor of Puerto Rico was slower in terms of the volume of aid he requested from different states. Now, it's hard to know how much difference any particular action or request caused, but the gap in aid flowing from other states to Puerto Rico compared with that went to Texas and Florida was significant. As of 2 weeks after Maria, about half as many states had sent aid to the island as it sent aid to Texas and Florida. It's hard to know how much that is A, the governor of Puerto Rico not requesting as much assistance, or B, and this came out in our reporting, states wondering whether the bankruptcy in Puerto Rico would mean they wouldn't get paid when they helped. So it's hard to spot directly, but I think the situation financially in Puerto Rico has affected a little bit the way other states and contractors and the federal government perhaps has tried to help out. And I think one of the lessons here is clearly, you don't want a slower response or a weakened response just because the place hit by a storm happened to be bankrupt. And I think this country hasn't really thought through how to incorporate that, how to make sure that the fiscal straits affecting a given government doesn't really get in the way of recovery.
Let me go back to Armando Valdez Prieto, who is in San Juan. Again, you were the former director of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico's Office of Management and Budget. What do you say to that? And doesn't it make it easy not to extend aid when there's this issue of bankruptcy?
Well, it's certainly a factor that needs to be taken into consideration. But again, what we're talking about here is 3.5 million U.S. citizens who, frankly, aren't necessarily responsible for decisions taken by government officials and even by the federal government that extended triple tax exemption to Puerto Rico debt, making it that much more attractive and making it that much easier for Puerto Rico to issue debt. This is a matter of life and death for U.S. citizens who are in Puerto Rico, many of whom may not necessarily have been born here, maybe U.S. citizens who moved here from other states. So I think that needs to be the main factor to consider here, not whether or not Puerto Rico can pay. I think it's a matter of how.
We lost our contact apparently there in San Juan. Once again, illustrative of the kind of problems that that island is going through. We'll try to get back to Mr. Valdez Prieto when we can. In the meantime, let me introduce Angela Albila, who is a Puerto Rican designer here in Los Angeles. She had been planning to go home later this week anyway. Now she's going home for a very different reason. Her plans have changed. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about your original plans and how they've changed.
Well, my original plan was to go home and help my mom with wedding planning, because we're getting married in November. But as of the recent pass of Hurricane Maria, I'm just going to help. I'm bringing supplies to local shelters and help my family in any way I can, because they have a plant nursery of ornamental plants, and they took a big hit from the hurricane. House is wet, like most of the structure in the farm is down production. They lost like 35% of production. And as we have been hearing from the panel prior before me, the government is not showing much help. So they're on their own for now.
So what are you taking?
I'm bringing adult diapers, baby diapers, blankets, like first day needs, whatever. I'm like cleaning supplies as well, candles, anything. I have a list that the shelters have been requiring or asking for, so whatever I can bring in my own bags, I'm bringing.
Tell us where your parents' house is and how much damage it suffered.
They are in the town of Juncos. That's approximately like 35 to 45 minutes away from San Juan. So most of the shade houses are down. They lost 35% of the production because the wind just lifted the ground cover and just like rolled up all of the plants. Trees, most of the trees are falling at the farm. A tree fell down in my own house, creating a hole, and all of the furniture is lost. And they have been requesting help from FEMA, but FEMA has only distributed 200 blue tarps in our town alone, and that's not even like, that's a small percentage of the population, which is unfortunately in worse position that my parents' house is.
What about the water?
They are fortunate that they have two wells because of the farm. It's supported by the agriculture department, but they don't have power, and they just heard from the news that they might not have power until the end of the year.
The end of the year?
End of the year, that's correct.
So you, like a lot of other young Puerto Ricans, have moved to the mainland. Why have you done that? And do you think this is going to cause a lot of other people to leave the island as well?
I moved for education. I moved to get my bachelor's and my master's, and it just happened that I found a good job over here. Unfortunately, yes, there has been like a big movement of our generation moving to the mainland to get jobs and support their families and provide a better life. And now, as of the recent past of the hurricane, more people are leaving, and those people are probably doctors, designers, like lawyers, everything that the island needs right now to help it move forward. But, I mean, I'm going back to see what I can do to help, and hopefully I can do more.
Let me go back to Armando Valdez Prieto. We have him back on the line. Are you concerned about people leaving, particularly young people, who might be the future of the island if they were to stay?
Absolutely. There were already projections by the U.S. Census Bureau that indicated that by the year 2050, Puerto Rico would have about 2.5 million people, which is the same level of population that we had back in 1950, so 100 years before that projected date. This is only expected to accelerate those migratory trends. The economy has essentially collapsed to zero. The young woman whose story I was just hearing, I think, is very typical for any number of businesses and farm interests in Puerto Rico that have been heavily affected. The fact that there's no electricity and that the projection is that by the 15th of December, we'll have 95% of customers back up and running. But even the U.S. Corps of Engineers said today that that's not likely. That affects business because you can't open stores, or it might be impractical or just not make economic sense to have a backup generator with what that costs to operate. And so the economy has collapsed, and that's just driving people to leave. And, of course, it's a vicious cycle. That'll make more businesses have to close because they don't have customers. And it's a very, very precarious situation for the economy and for Puerto Rican society at large.
Angela Albella, back to you. In Juncos, where your parents are, you said they may not get electricity until the end of the year. Can they stay in business? Can they keep their nursery going? Is there going to be a customer base?
Well, they have power plants, as many Puerto Ricans have but it's not like they can keep the business forever running on power plant, because obviously that has to trickle like gas. Will there be enough gas to support like the whole island? But what they've been trying is to get aid from the government, but unfortunately they're not providing any help, and most of the farm businesses are not insured by the government because there's no security that they will get their money back. So right now they're just on the waiting game, unfortunately.
What do you hear about hospitals and people who are ill?
I've heard that one of the main hospitals, the Centro Médico in Puerto Rico, they just lost power again. And that's really sad because there's a lot of people who depend on it, like the breathing machines, like MRI, all of these systems that are down, and people need them. I've heard from like close families and close friends that have to leave the island to have babies or to take their elderly parents to take the proper care. And most of them are going to either Florida or New Jersey or New York.
Let me go back to Raul Reyes with both NBC and CNN. You've said that President Trump made this a political issue when it didn't have to be. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think he made it a political issue in a couple ways. One was that first weekend when the hurricane was literally happening, you know, when the island was being hit head on. He spent most of that weekend, you know, he was tweeting about football players and that flag controversy and whether or not they should be kneeling and all of that, when he really could have used, for example, just for in terms of something small that he could have done, a small gesture, he could have used that opportunity to use his, you know, his bully pulpit, which is an immense platform on Twitter alone, to remind Americans that Puerto Ricans are on the island, are our fellow citizens, because we've seen polls this year showing that just about half of Americans, only about half of Americans knew that to begin with. And then engaging into, he got into this very personal, well, he started, I think it's sort of a one-sided battle with the mayor of San Juan. And he says that she attacked him. And, I mean, all she was doing was literally begging for help. And he took that as almost a personal affront and really was lashing out at her and, you know, and being very, giving a lot of very negative pushback. And I think the damage that that does is that to a lot of people who maybe don't have connections to the islands, maybe they don't live in a place where there's, a vibrant Puerto Rican community or Hispanic community, they see this as something that, oh, it's the Democrats or liberals criticizing Trump. And, it starts to fall into this partisan divide, which unfortunately is very much part of the way we live now. So
let me interrupt you, if I may, and go back to Angel Albella before we lose our time and ask you, have you heard others in this country, Latinos, Puerto Ricans, and others, express the kind of view we just heard from Raul Reyes? Are people angry at the president?
They are very much angry, and especially when he came over to the island and started throwing those paper towels, as the whole world saw that, everybody found that very disrespectful and more disrespectful to the mayor of San Juan, who was trying knee-deep in, like, filthy water, and the president was just out playing golf. So how, and we're still saying, like, we are American citizens, like, we deserve some sort of respect and support from the federal government, not just, like, a Twitter war with the president, with the governor, or, like, the mayor. So we just want to be heard, and we want help.
And Christopher Flavel with Bloomberg, you're in touch with FEMA and with the military to a certain extent, not necessarily desired on your own. Are they beefing up? Are they going to try to fix this in a hurry?
Well, I'm sure at this point they realize how bad an issue this is and how poorly perceived their response has been. I think the real question is, what can they do? How much more can they pour to the island? And more to the point, how can they be more ready next time? It is not just a Puerto Rico story. There are more storms like this.
All right. Christopher Flavel with Bloomberg News. Armando Valdez Prieto in San Juan. Raul Reyes with NBC and CNN. Angela Abela, a Puerto Rican designer here in Los Angeles, about to go home and help her family instead of planning her wedding. Thank you all so much for being on our program today. Back in a moment with Masha Gessen. This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney here with today's Talking Point. Our guest, Masha Gessen, whose books and opinion columns feature dire warnings about Russia. She was born in the Soviet Union, came to the U.S. with her parents as a child. When political change was underway, she returned to Moscow in the 1990s. There, she became a leading journalist and a critic of President Vladimir Putin. So much of a critic, she fled back to the U.S. in 2013. She says the Soviet bureaucracy was never dismantled and that it's become a tool for the former KGB agent to solidify power.
He's basically built a mafia state on the ruins of a totalitarian regime. And as a result, a lot of the totalitarian habits have sort of reconstituted themselves, and a lot of the totalitarian society's institutions have reconstituted themselves. And so it's now a mafia state that rules over a totalitarian society.
Masha Gessen's latest book is called The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. She explains the history of her home country through the stories of four different people.
Ultimately, I wanted to write a book about trauma. I was trying to show something fairly complicated, which is, you know, not trauma that is based on a living memory, but rather something that's passed on from generation to generation, what we now call intergenerational trauma. And it's not specific to the four people I'm describing. It is the story of the entire society. But I wanted to focus on four people who grew up in the 90s. And sort of by looking out from the inside of their heads, I thought I could show what happened.
One of the characters, sort of an observing character that you use, is a Russian psychoanalyst who diagnoses Mother Russia as depressed and suicidal. You quote her as saying this country wanted to kill itself. How can that be that an entire society would do that?
Well, that's the very end of the book where she sort of speculates. And she says, well, you know, one way to analyze what's happened here is that an entire society can have a death drive. It's an awfully dark note for her to end on, but it does answer some of the questions that I raised earlier in the book. And one of the questions concerns Russia's excess mortality. Russia has more people dying earlier than any peaceful country in the world or any country in peacetime. Russia has been experiencing depopulation since the 1950s. I mean, the country has literally been dying off. And none of the usual explanations, when you look at it closely, none of the usual explanations actually work. It's not vodka that's killing people. It's not cigarettes. It's not bad diet. It's not lack of exercise. It's not the environment, because they're actually ways to measure the effect of all of those things. And they explain, if anything, about half of the excess mortality in Russia. And then the question is, what's the other half? And there's a wonderful researcher of Russian demographics, an American named Nicholas Eberstadt, who has suggested that perhaps Russians are dying of depression. And Arutyunyan, knowing nothing of Eberstadt's research, sort of picks up that theme, because that's certainly something that she sees in her patients and all around her.
The psychoanalyzing of the society is throughout your book, and you talk about, you mentioned trauma, you talk about a state of anxiety, and how that generates a need for authority. Is that what explains Putin's ability to stay in power?
I think it explains a lot of it. It certainly explains his appeal. And this is perhaps the part of the book that's most relevant to Americans reading it right now. I spend a little bit of time in the book reviewing the theories of Eric Fromm, the great psychoanalyst and social psychologist, who wrote a book in 1940 in which he suggested an explanation for how Hitler came to power. And his theory was that there are times in human history when people feel so uncertain, the future seems so unclear and so unpredictable, that freedom becomes an unbearable burden. And he thinks that that's what happened, for example, at the end of as feudalism was ending in Europe. That's what happened in Europe in the 1920s and 30s, when there was a massive turn away from democracy. And I'm suggesting that that is perhaps what happened in Russia after the 1990s, when freedom became an unbearable burden.
What happened in the 1990s after Yeltsin took over, Boris Yeltsin took over from Mikhail Gorbachev, and there was much celebration about Russia turning into a free democratic state?
So what happened was great economic reforms that changed people's lives profoundly and created increased inequality and created great uncertainty. What happened was major political reform, although not particularly thorough. What didn't happen was decommunization, right? The communist ideology was never confronted. It was sort of just set aside on a, you know, like on a corner shelf in the room. And what didn't happen was any kind of confrontation with the past. There was no reckoning with the decades of state terror. And I think that what didn't happen is just as important as what did happen. And ultimately, the fact that Russia never sort of entered a post-Soviet period, Russia never looked for a post-imperial identity for itself. Russia never looked, Russia never repudiated even something as horrible as Stalinism, enabled what happened in the 2000s after Putin came to power.
Nobody said that Stalin was, in fact, a terrible mark on history and that Russians should be ashamed of the sort of thing that happened in Germany with regard to Hitler?
There were some people who said that, but it wasn't a line that was adopted by the entire country. And in fact, you know, under Putin, this has become more and more pronounced. Putin has generally referred to Stalin as primarily the leader who won World War II. And World War II has become the cornerstone myth of contemporary Russia. As the sociologist character in my book, I mean, he's a real person and he's a great, great sociologist, Lev Gutkov, as he puts it, World War II is the perfect myth because it shines its lights both backwards and forwards. Looking backwards, it justifies all the terror that came before World War II. Looking forward, it explains how the Soviet Union became a superpower. And so that's the greatness that Putin harkens back to when he talks about making Russia great again. And as for terror, he basically takes the line, and I think it's common throughout Russia now, that, well, it's unfortunate, but it was sort of a side effect of the greatness.
Late in the book, you talk about Moscow destroying low-rise buildings and removing sidewalks and walkways, leaving pedestrians to maneuver on icy streets and falling and injuring themselves. What's that all about?
Moscow was built in its current incarnation as the capital of a totalitarian state. It has a very particular kind of architecture. The buildings are enormous. They have, you know, three-story tall archways. They are designed to make people feel tiny and insignificant. You look sort of off into the distance, and you don't. There's nothing to catch your eye. There's nothing at human level. Everything is just so much larger than life. And in the 90s, during the era of economic reforms, that landscape changed. There were all these low-rise stores that popped up, and the city sort of started being lived at street level on a human scale. And I think that the mayor's desire to eliminate that human scale and to restore the grandeur of a totalitarian capital is not doesn't stem just from corruption. I think it's a real aesthetic drive to recreate that sense of sort of relationship between people and power. And I think that that is also a hugely important instrument of control. Hannah Arendt wrote about totalitarianism robbing people of space, right, of private space, of mushing people together. This is sort of the flip side of that process. When there's no place for people to inhabit, when they are either alone in a very large space or sort of smushed up together with other people, they can't feel like people. They don't feel like individuals. They don't experience their autonomy in a physical way. And, you know, we don't even begin to understand what it does to the psyche, but it's horribly destructive.
So how does this affect the characters that you talk about? And I say they're characters. They're, in fact, real people in your book. And how does your portrayal of them illustrate what you're trying to demonstrate?
The people I'm writing about actually aren't representative in the traditional sort of journalistic sense. I mean, journalists often will look for people who can serve as stand-ins for millions of others. I tried to do something a little bit different because I wanted to go into such great detail that I wanted people who really are extraordinary and who have fascinating stories. So it's more their experiences that stand in for the experience of so many people in society. And they have been confronted with this loss of autonomy, with this loss of agency, with a state that exerts greater and greater control and that resurrects the institutions of a totalitarian society. One example, and this is one of my favorite scenes in the book, when one of the people in the book tries to ride the subway. And he has just arrived in Moscow from a different city, and so he doesn't have a multi-ride ticket. And he stands in line for an hour, and he's just absolutely miserable. And so he decides that maybe he can at least make life easier for the other people standing in line. So he buys a multi-ride ticket and calls out to people, "Look, I have 50 rides on this ticket. Go ahead, I'm going to let you through." You know, he's paid for these rides. And he immediately gets arrested. And the policeman can't explain to him why he's arrested, because he hasn't done anything illegal. But the policeman has a very strong sense that something like this shouldn't happen. And that sense that order should be enforced and that misery should be evenly spread and nothing should be allowed to become more efficient and any kind of individual initiative must be immediately put down, it's so pervasive, it's stronger than any law can possibly be.
Is that traumatic?
I think it is traumatic. It's the result of trauma. I mean, when I say trauma, what I mean is that Russian society, just like an individual who has lived through hugely traumatic experiences, especially ones that were stretched out in time, has developed survival mechanisms that are appropriate to that experience, right? Just like a woman who maybe has been trafficked has developed survival mechanisms that are appropriate to the situation of being trafficked and aren't great and won't serve her very well once she's not being abused. So an entire society has developed the mechanisms for survival in a situation of terror, but these mechanisms are not good for a situation of liberation and a fledgling democracy. And it makes people feel more comfortable. It makes an entire society to feel more comfortable when it recreates an earlier situation of tight control and everybody sort of enforcing rules on everybody else.
That was part one of my interview with Masha Gessen about her book, The Future is History. Tomorrow, I'll ask her about the parallel she sees between Putin's Russia and Donald Trump's America. I'm Orin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.